Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. While things have consistently changed throughout the pandemic, one thing has stayed the same. Misinformation. From vaccines to masks, COVID treatments, even elections, we're not only immersed in it, but we're also fielding those claims ourselves in daily conversations. While some social media sites eventually took it upon themselves to alert users about misinformation in articles and images that they're sharing, the California State Legislature is hoping to take things a step further. Joining us now to talk about how the California legislature is planning to combat misinformation is CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. Nicole, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, nice to be here.
All right, so to kick things off, Democratic State Senator from Sacramento, Richard Pan, introduced Senate Bill 1018. Senator Pan, who is also a physician, is no stranger to heated vaccine legislation even before the pandemic. What does he hope to accomplish with misinformation?
Well, he really wants to crack down on it and crack down on people who are sharing it. Like you said, even before the pandemic, he ran some vaccine bills that were seen as really controversial. He's been targeted online by anti-vaccine activists and really gone after, you know, social media and its role in spreading this kind of misinformation. He said that it's been really devastating during the pandemic. And years ago, we saw a study that showed that falsehoods and mistruths can spread even faster online than true information. So this is sort of his way of getting after that and trying to make an impact.
So how does it go further than what sites like Facebook and Twitter are already doing and helping people make informed decisions about what they're sharing online?
Yeah, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, they already label some posts about the pandemic with some sort of advisories. You may have seen them. It says, you know, learn more about COVID-19 and vaccines. If you tap that advisory, it takes you to the CDC website. This bill is very different than that. It would require these social media platforms to essentially make their algorithms public and even share that information with researchers, which would be a huge deal for these companies, and they will very likely fight this legislation, arguing that these are, you know, protected intellectual property, business trade secrets, all of that. So here's Dr. Pan talking about that.
Of course, there's a back and forth as this legislation is going through as to what's truly necessary to do that and what's not. But no one has ever said that, oh, the state has absolutely no right ever to look at, you know, things about a particular product or service. If it impinges on the safety of the public, that we don't have a right to know some that information to be able to protect the public.
He kind of compared it to, you know, a car. We might not be able to build cars, but people are able to look up, you know, how they're built and what's in them exactly.
All right. So as we wait and see how that plays out, there's another bill introduced by Assemblymember Evan Lowe, a Democrat from Campbell, which would specifically affect doctors who are spreading false information about the pandemic, possible treatments and vaccines. What does Assemblymember Lowe hope to accomplish with this one?
Yeah, this bill would let the California Medical Board investigate doctors and discipline them for sharing disinformation about COVID-19 and the vaccine, kind of, you know, this other realm of misinformation. It's pointed out, though, that, you know, throughout the pandemic, a lot of information has changed as, you know, we learn more about the virus and as the virus itself changes. Lowe says this is very much going after this small group of doctors that is spreading just blatant lies about the virus and about the vaccine. And he had a doctor named Nick Sawyer, who's an emergency room doctor here in Sacramento, you know, talking about his experience in the emergency room and how he has had patients very sick, basically repeating these lies back to him. Things like, you know, the vaccine will magnetize your body, or the vaccine kills more people than the virus itself. Just blatant lies. So here's Dr. Sawyer.
Physicians who are out there lending their credibility as physicians and saying these things, these are the physicians that need to be disciplined and need to have their license suspended or revoked according to what the medical board thinks is most appropriate. But everything else in between, the nuance, Medicine obviously evolves over time, and we understand that. But many of the lies and the rhetoric that we hear coming out of these physicians are just simply not true.
And Nicole, that nuance is really key, because an overarching argument to all of this is our right to free speech. I mean, what did law experts have to say about this bill?
Yeah, so what this bill would actually do is classify spreading false information about the pandemic specifically as unprofessional conduct. So it would make it this professional standard that physicians have to follow. And if they don't follow it, then they're subject to investigation and discipline, which in this case would be, they could be suspended or have their license revoked.
What disciplinary action is already in place then for doctors who spread misinformation?
Yeah, it's a good question. The medical board, it seems like, already has some power to do this. They have revoked doctors' licenses before, but Assemblymember Lowe says that it's more reactionary and complaint-driven. So he says this would give the board the tools to do this more proactively. However, there are questions about, you know, whether the board actually has the resources to do that, and it has all these other things to deal with as well.
Right. A bill is one thing. Resources are entirely another thing. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. I want to bring in CAP Radio anchor Randall White, because Nicole, you and Randall will be talking about California's approach to the pandemic as we move into yet another phase. Randall, welcome to Insight.
Nice to see you, Vicky.
Well, Randall, your special coverage starts at 3 p.m. You have a lot planned for that hour. While California Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Mark Galli already laid out a lot on Monday, what are some of the things that you're hoping the governor will touch on?
Well, Dr. Galli is announcing even more today prior to Governor Newsom. And whatever he clarifies from his comments on Monday or perhaps adds to the state's plans, we will be sure to include in the show at 3 o'clock. As for the governor, we expect him to lay out the state's plans for moving beyond the latest Omicron surge and what some have described, including Newsom, as an endemic phase of the virus. The governor's office has been pretty tight-lipped, however, about what exactly that will include, which is why we decided to put together a statewide show to help all of the public radio listeners from San Diego to Chico better understand what the plan is. He does say his focus will be on continued readiness, awareness, and flexibility as we adapt to the evolving pandemic. And he did use the word pandemic several times in his press statement that he sent out to reporters explaining what's going on tomorrow. I did not see the word endemic in there, so maybe he's pulling back a bit on that. We'll see. But one quick thing, Vicky, the governor had also been hush-hush about when and where his press conference would be today. And last night, we learned it'll be at 3:15 this afternoon in San Bernardino County, which might seem like a gift to have him speaking during our show, but we really planned it as a distillation show where we break down what he said, not as a taking it live coverage. So we have a lot to work out between now and 3 o'clock to figure out what shape the show will take exactly.
Well, you certainly are up to the task. And you mentioned San Bernardino County. Obviously, locations that the governor chooses are for specific reasons, essentially to highlight what's next. Any idea what this location signals?
You know, it is an election year, so I imagine every single thing that the governor plans to do has, you know, some connection to that. But really, when it comes to the politics and such, that's where CAP Radio's Nicole Nixon, who's also on the line here, will come in. She'll help us get a grasp of any political angles that the governor might have with this, as well as several other reporters that we'll hear from, including Jackie Fortier, KPCC's senior health reporter, and KPBS health and business reporter Matt Hoffman.
Yeah, Nicole, I mean, we can't ignore the fact it's a midterm year. So how is politics weaving its way in today's special coverage?
I mean, one thing that I'm really going to be looking for is the governor has talked a lot about in the past week or so how in this next phase, local governments will be able to go stricter than the state based on conditions in their areas. And that's something that's kind of been the case throughout the past year. I'm really interested to watch the degree to which that will happen and whether it's, if people are upset about restrictions, if this shifts the blame from the governor and the state and places it directly on local officials, you know, health officers and county supervisors, whether the governor will be able to sort of wash his hands of this during this election year.
A core issue in all of this is the effects the pandemic has had on students and their mental health. I mean, what are you going? You're going to unpack the effects of this. I mean, it's not just a synopsis of what the governor said, but going beyond and the context surrounding it. Right, Randall?
That's right. We'll hear from Joe Hong, CalMatters education reporter, who has been following those issues throughout the pandemic, and he will help distill that aspect and also things that Dr. Galley said earlier in the week and will say later today. Of course, a lot of the tug of war in all of that is continued masking in the schools and, you know, vaccination for the students.
You know, California, not an island, you know, so what California is doing is going to affect or potentially have national trends. What are you hearing from physicians or researchers who are doing research on COVID-19 trends over the past couple of years? What do they have to say about California's strategy shift towards an endemic, potentially?
Yeah, I spoke with Dr. Ali Mokhtad with the University of Washington, and, you know, they provide a lot of the data that the states and really the countries around the world. Dr. Mokhtad told me that he's spoken one-on-one with prime ministers. He says absolutely that the state of California is in contact with him. And he says, according to his data, that it is time to move into an endemic phase. But he still feels people should wear masks in sensitive situations. He himself will continue to wear a mask, but says it is time for relaxing government mandates. And we'll also hear a bit from Dr. Eric Topol with Scripps Research in San Diego, who has reviewed the governor's plan, but says he likes it, but he says it needs to be more bold and comprehensive. And maybe we'll get a little more into what that means.
Yeah, likes it, but with some caveats. Dr. Galley gave that presser on Monday, as we touched upon. But Nicole, what are some of the things that you're expecting the governor to cover that weren't already covered by Dr. Galley on Monday?
Yeah, the focus of Galley's event on Monday was really about schools. I mean, he talked about trends over the past month of the Omicron surge, you know, going down. But there's been a lot of pressure ramping up to end mask requirements in schools. Dr. Galley said that is not going to happen yet. He's going to reevaluate all the data at the end of the month. Here's what he meant by that.
What does that mean? It means we're going to look at information on case rates, confirm what I just showed you that we believe is going to happen, which are the case numbers will continue to come down, test positivity will come down, hospitalizations, both adult and pediatric, will come down, and we're watching vaccine rates. We will use this opportunity to remind students, families, that this is a great chance to get vaccinated, that vaccines are free, safe, and effective, that they do a lot to help protect not just the individuals, but the community at large.
I would expect that what the governor talks about today will touch on that, you know, why it's important to get vaccinated, but it will be much more comprehensive, not just focused on schools, but really how the state as a whole, regionally, and how us as individuals can move forward in the coming weeks as this surge continues to fall.
Yeah, a lot of unanswered questions that hopefully we get some answers to today. And the two of you are just going to be some busy bees before the special coverage.
Right.
Thank you so much, Randall and Nicole.
You Thanks. Bet, Vicky.
That is Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon and Cap Radio anchor Randall White. You can tune in to the special coverage at 3 p.m. and listen online at capradio.org. Up next, the Central Valley is breaking ground on a pilot to install solar panels over irrigation canals. We'll learn how combining water and sunlight can meet the state's energy demands. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California's oldest irrigation district will be testing a plan to combine water and sunlight to meet 21st century energy demands. The Central Valley area of Turlock is launching Project Nexus. That's a pilot program to build solar panels over roughly 2 miles of its canals near the communities of Ceres and Hickman. The project is a first of its kind in the nation, exploring the potential benefits and feasibility of building these panels over canals statewide. According to a study co-authored by UC Merced and UC Santa Cruz, if Project Nexus is successful and implemented across 4,000 miles of the state's water delivery system, California could see significant water, energy, and cost savings. But that same study admits the overall benefits and risks associated with this plan aren't entirely known, since a project of this scale has never been attempted before in the United States. Here to tell us more about this unique energy project and how it hopes to address some of these unknowns is Josh Weimer with the Turlock Irrigation District. Josh, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What is Project Nexus and why did the Irrigation District decide to pursue it?
Yeah, Project Nexus is really a pilot project that will serve as a proof of concept for that UC Merced study that you just mentioned. And that study looked at covering 4,000 miles of irrigation canals and aqueducts and what could be the potential water supply and quality savings and also renewable energy generation. And so when that study came out, our general manager, Michelle Reimer, she was very interested in this concept and picked up the phone and called the lead researchers. And that began months of conversation and dialogue and got us to the point where we're at today, where we're hoping to break ground on these pilot projects in the fall.
Help us visualize this symbiotic relationship between water and energy management. How will these panels benefit the water and the canal itself and vice versa?
The water energy nexus in California is really a topic that utilities in the water and energy space talk about. There's a nexus between generating power requires water, and then also to move and to treat water requires a lot of energy. And so this water energy nexus is something that we are always interested in seeing. How can we be better stewards of those resources? How can we help meet our goals? But Project Nexus really builds on that. And we are using existing infrastructure, our canals, and placing solar panels on top of that. Not only is that water energy nexus, but it builds upon that. We're potentially having shade and wind blocking of the irrigation canals that could reduce evaporation. And also the water underneath the solar panels could potentially cool and make the solar panels more efficient, therefore producing more energy. And so really Project Nexus for TID builds on a historic stewardship that we have in the water energy nexus. We've been providing carbon-free energy since 1923 when we built the old Don Pedro reservoir. And our irrigation canals already have many hydro systems on them. And so this is another way for us to provide carbon-free energy to our customers utilizing our irrigation canals.
Well, Turlock, the irrigation district, is going to be the first in the country. The only other place in the world that this project has been undertaken is in India. What did you learn from the project in India to help your vision of the pilot program here in the Central Valley?
The project in India is very interesting. And I should mention that we have, this is a private, public, and academic partnership, Project Nexus. And so Department of Water Resources, the UC Merced system, and Solar Aqua Grid, who's a project manager of this, they have great connections with the India company. And they've looked and studied and researched how they have done their mounting system over the canals. Our project is a little bit different. And really it's different in the way that we are going to be mounting and piloting how to span such a large portion of our canals. In India, they used a lot of steel and they put it right over the top of the canals. And in one other pilot, they actually put a pylon in the middle of the infrastructure. In the middle of the canals. Our system is going to be different. We're going to span that, making sure that we're not in any way interrupting our irrigation deliveries or our ability to maintain the canals. And so while we learned and we'll build on the India pilots, this is really a different structure, and it's something that we're excited to see if it can work in our territory.
Well, while this is being constructed, then, how would it benefit or even impact the irrigation customers that you serve and the customers who rely on your power?
That's a great question. Part of what we are critically focused on is ensuring that any type of project around our canal will in no way impact our water deliveries or our ability to maintain those canals. Our irrigation canals are over 100 years old. We have a tremendous construction and maintenance team here that keeps those canals providing that, you know, reliable supply of surface water to our growers. We are interested in the potential aquatic growth reduction that putting solar panels over the canals might provide. And that would potentially reduce the amount of maintenance we have to do, increasing the reliability of that water delivery. And so we're very interested in that on the water side. And then we're an electric provider. We have renewable mandates that we are well on our way to meet, but this is renewable power. And this is going to help our reduce the cost to our customers to meet those mandates.
All right. Well, when it comes to results, how much power is expected to come from this project?
This project is in two phases, spanning two different portions of our canals. We have 250 miles of canals in our service territory, all different shapes and sizes, facing different directions. And so one of the sections is going to be spanning a smaller portion of our canal, 20 to 25 feet wide. And that's going to produce about 4 megawatts of solar power. And the other section is about 100 feet wide, and that's going to produce about 1 megawatt. So total 5 megawatts of solar that will help benefit our customers.
And help us, what is 5 megawatts of solar in terms of how meaningful is that?
It is a pilot. It's a smaller amount of renewable energy, but any carbon-free energy is a benefit to our customers. And so this is a pilot project. It's a small scale, but it is something that we hope will prove the proof of concept that is in that academic research paper. And you know, we have 250 miles of canals. In our area, anytime that we want to do a renewable project, say putting solar in the ground, it brings a large cost to our ratepayers because we do have such a reliable supply of surface water. So our ag land is very expensive. And so one of the things that we're very interested in is if we have the ability to scale this on more of our canals, that's going to potentially reduce the cost of putting in these renewable power projects, therefore reducing the cost to our customers because we're community owned. We're owned by our ratepayers, and any expenses that we have is directly passed along to them.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with the Turlock Irrigation District about a pilot project that will place solar panels over irrigation canals to combine water and sunlight to meet the state energy demands. Now, we know there are a lot of unknowns with this, and this also comes as California's water conveyance system is one of the world's largest, but some of its canals are in danger of failing, and you have the oldest canals in the state. What is the current state of the Turlock Irrigation District's canals, and will building these panels impact their integrity?
Our canals, as I mentioned, we have a tremendous team of maintenance staff and engineers at the district who make sure that our canals are sound, they're engineered correctly, that there's no issues. And then when issues do arrive, they're able to fix them right away. So our canals are in very good shape. Our area does not have land subsidence, which happens in other parts of the states, which impacts the canals conveyance and provides a lot of issues there. And so we have a tremendous team here that makes sure that during the season and in the off season that our canals are up to delivering the task of supplying that surface water to our growers without any deliveries, but in any issues. But it is something that we're very interested in, and is designing this system so it doesn't minimize our impact to maintain these canals. And so that's something that we're designing too. We know that there's going to be some challenges doing the first in the nation anything provides a lot of unknowns, but our team is up to the task. And they're interested to try out some new mechanisms to clean and to maintain those canals because of the potential benefits of this project.
Well, given that you anticipate challenges and this is a pilot project, the first of its kind in the country, what contingency plans are you figuring out when things do go wrong?
We're designing to make sure that if there is any issues in our canal system or with these panels, that in no way would it impact us to be able to get in and maintain and to fix those issues. And so we want to make sure that while this does provide a potentially new source of renewable power and potentially some water savings, we can't in any way jeopardize what our core function is at TID, and that is to provide reliable and affordable irrigation water and electricity to our customers.
That brings me to something that you touched upon, because you touched upon that some of the solar panels in this project will be 20 feet wide, but others will be over 100 feet wide. What's going to go into the maintenance of these solar panels hovering over 100 feet of water?
And that's one of the things that we're interested in studying as part of this pilot project. So our research team, our partners at UC Merced are very interested in studying every single component of this, from the construction, the maintenance, the cleaning. There's a lot of potential technology out there of how to maintain and clean panels that are span over 100 feet or are up 20 feet off of the ground. And how do you maintain and clean panels during the irrigation season when there's water in the canal and you don't have access to it? And so that is definitely one thing that we are studying and going to be piloting to see how can you maintain the canal system and the solar system during the irrigation season. So it's something that we're designing to and we'll be studying heavily over the coming years.
And that goes along with you're including an educational component to this project, correct?
Yeah, that is our goal. At one location, we're calling the Ceres Innovation Center, and we're going to have solar over canals at that location, energy storage at that location. And then we're also on the irrigation side, we're continually doing water efficiency programs to capture and save water. And so we have a regulating reservoir that is going into that site. And so we really do hope that this can be an education piece for our community, for grade school, for college areas, and then also just for the community at large that is interested in this technology, different associations, different water agencies who are curious about this technology and really want to see firsthand how it operates before they potentially go and make a similar investment.
As we mentioned, you know, going off of that innovation center, you know, the study from UC Merced and UC Santa Cruz, which essentially inspired this project, stated that despite the potential advantages of over canal solar arrays, the overall economic, environmental, and social benefits at the scale of a major conveyance network are unknown. That is a huge, overwhelming lift. How do you hope this project will answer those unknowns in a meaningful and tangible way?
Yeah, we really are hoping to bring this academic study to reality and to test some of these theories and see how will this help California not only meet our climate goals, but you know we're in the middle of a drought currently. And so how can we potentially utilize these co-benefits to save additional water, to provide better water quality for both our irrigation and drinking water customers? And really this type of project has the ability to meet the state's climate goals and water goals. And so we're hopeful that our pilot project, while small initially, will help build out larger scalability models to see, is this something that makes sense? In our case, we think it does because we already have the land purchased. This is land that we're already utilizing. And so if we're able to put this renewable energy on this existing infrastructure, rather than taking some of the most productive ag lands out of production, we think that this is potentially a win-win, and we're very excited to be partnering and kind of leading the charge in the nation.
Given that California, and especially where you are in the Central Valley with agriculture, we're living with continuous drought conditions or drought-like conditions. How has your role as an irrigation district changed over the years?
Well, one of our core functions at TID is preparing for droughts. We're an irrigation district that has been in operation for 135 years. We have made tremendous investments in that 135 years. We're not part of the state or federal water project. We're our own local agency. Our community has taken really our future in our own hands and has invested in a sustainable supply of water and has made the tough decisions over the years to cut back in anticipation for a multi-year drought. And so our board of directors, we have five locally elected board of directors, they start making those decisions years in advance to ensure that our growers have water supplies to prepare for a multi-year drought. And so this has the potential for us to help on the water side with some evaporation savings, but in this day and age, any additional water is an additional benefit to our community.
Yeah. Given that you're community owned and you're not part of the California State Water Project, what is the benefit to being that small and potentially that nimble, right?
It's incredibly beneficial. We have the ability to have our destiny in our hands. Our board is able to make these decisions and to operate our water resources for our community. We have taken tremendous investments in the last few decades, not only to improve our aging infrastructure, but to look to new technologies. TID has been able to partner with NASA to help pilot the snow surveys to bring us into the 21st century to reimagine how we study what is up in the watershed. And then working with also atmospheric river research. And so we are looking at all stages of our irrigation and electric delivery to see how can we move forward to serve the next 135 years.
Yeah, those are some pretty cool partnerships. When it comes to this recent project, final question, when do you hope it will begin and how soon will we see these solar panels over your canals?
Our plan is to break ground this fall and to have, our hope is to have construction completed by next fall. So in the end of 2023. And then we're gonna have a few years of additional research with our partners at that time. And to be able to provide the results of how did this work out in TID and how could this potentially scale to the rest of the state.
Yeah, that is exciting stuff. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vicki. I appreciate it.
Josh Weimer is the External Affairs Manager with the Turlock Irrigation District, providing more details on Project Nexus, a first-of-its-kind project in the nation building solar panels over canals in the Central Valley. Still ahead, a conversation with musician Joshua Radin ahead of his Sacramento concert at the Sophia. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Singer and songwriter Joshua Radin spent much of the COVID-19 lockdowns alone in his Los Angeles home. So he took the time to search within and find an answer to one of his greatest fears. Out of that journey of self-discovery came Radin's ninth album, The Ghost and the Wall. Released in 2021, the album is an intimate glimpse into the 47-year-old's vulnerabilities with lyrics and melodies that have resonated with millions of his fans. The album was also written and recorded without Radin ever meeting his producer face-to-face. Radin is no longer home alone. His bags and guitar are happily packed, and he's touring the country for the first time in 2 years. His next stop is right here in Sacramento at the Sophia this Saturday night. Here to talk about his latest album and share some of his new tracks is singer and songwriter Joshua Radin. Joshua, welcome to Insight. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So The Ghost in the Wall is your ninth album, but let's just quickly start from the beginning. You sort of serendipitously stumbled into a career in music, partly thanks to a friendship with an actor. How did that unexpectedly help launch your career?
Well, I didn't grow up playing any music at all. I was just a fan. I would see concerts and buy records and obsessed with music. But I never played an instrument or, you know, when I would sing, it would just be in the shower or in the car, like most people. And I just always would go to see concerts and think, well, I didn't start playing music when I was a kid, like most of these musicians. So it's way too late for me. And one day, I was about to turn 30 years old. I was living in New York City and I was a struggling screenwriter, you know, just sort of getting by, paying the bills, but not succeeding the way I wanted to succeed. So I got a guitar and I learned a few chords sitting on the couch every time I was writing a screenplay, and I would sort of be questioning what a character would say in the next scene or something like that. And you know, the guitar, like learning a chord, a new chord or strumming or something like that on the guitar on the couch would be very meditative for me. And it would open my mind in a different creative way. And so I just started learning a few chords and learning a couple cover songs by like Bob Dylan and Paul Simon and the Beatles. And And then after about 6 months, I knew a few chords, and I just thought, well, I'm a writer. Maybe I'll try to write one of my own songs. So I wrote this song called Winter. It was about this breakup I was going through with this girl that I had been living with in New York for 6 years. And I didn't really know how to tell her that I thought the relationship should be over, that we should just be friends. And so I poured it all into a song. And I found that I was able to be more honest in that 3.5 minute song than I ever had been able to be. I had never been able to express myself so honestly in a screenplay or paintings I had done or anything I had done creatively up until that point. So I thought, this just feels like home. And I just never looked back. And I've just been writing songs ever since.
And that friend was Zach Braff, right? From the TV show Scrubs?
Yeah, we met in college, actually. And then both of us would give each other notes on our screenplays while we were waiting tables. And then when he made that movie, Garden State, the soundtrack became so popular amongst a younger audience. And I was one of the people helping him come up with songs for that soundtrack. But I hadn't written any songs yet. So when the soundtrack came out and won a Grammy and went platinum, I thought to myself, you know what? Look at all these kids loving Paul Simon and Nick Drake and, you know, these acoustic kind of songs. And I was like, well, that's kind of the stuff that I love and that I want to write. So it inspired me to write my first song. And I played the song for him. It was called Winter. He was in my apartment, saw a guitar. And he was like, you play guitar? I was like, I was like, well, I haven't played for anybody. I'm too shy. I never wanted to be on stage or, you know, in the public eye or, you know, in a spotlight or anything. So he kept coaxing me and he said, play me a song. And so I was like, well, you got to turn around because I'm too shy. And so he turned around and I played him this song and he turned around and he had these tears in his eyes. And he said, you got to record that song. I love it. And maybe the producers of Scrubs will, you know, just record a demo and maybe the producers of Scrubs will want to use it on the show. They're always looking for new music. So I did. And 3 weeks later, Bill Lawrence, the producer of the show, the creator of the show, he emailed me and said, I love this song. I've got the perfect spot for it on the show. Would you mind if we use it? And I was like, what? Are you kidding? Of course, that'd be incredible. And the show aired a week later. And then the website for NBC, which the show was on at the time, crashed because so many people were trying to find out who wrote that song, who's singing, you know, where do we find that song? And when Bill told me that, I said, all right, I'm moving to Los Angeles and I'm going to try this. I'm going to try this out and see what happens. And like I said, I never looked back. It was, a big break, but it wasn't like all of a sudden I had a fan base or anything like that. It was just an encouragement, really.
Yeah.
To say wow, there are people out there that love this song. So I'm going to write more. And, then every song I wrote after that pretty much was on some TV show or movie or something like that. So I have so much to thank when it comes to Bill and Zach.
I gotta tell you, Garden State, that soundtrack got me through college. And when I was preparing for the interview with you, I went back to that episode of Scrubs and listened to your song. And it was such an, I think it's one of people's favorite episodes. Brandon Fraser was a guest and the song was just so powerful. With that and the years since, you know, you just are starting a coast-to-coast tour, which includes a performance in Sacramento Saturday night. How does it feel to be out of the house and performing in front of fans again after 2 years?
I wish, you know, it's I feel terrible that I'm a writer and I can't come up with a good analogy for how it feels because it feels too good. Being in lockdown, you know, I lived in my house in L.A. alone. LA was just not the place to be during the pandemic at all. And we, you know, everything was, we took it so seriously. I had a friend of mine who very early on in the pandemic contracted COVID and actually passed away from it. Oh, and he was only 41 years old and a healthy person. And so my friends and I in our little pod, our little pod group of friends, we took it so seriously. I mean, we watched our friend pass away and, So we were terrified the entire time. And I went weeks and weeks in my house without seeing a human being. So that was horrible, but also not being able to play music for people and having to cancel tours and just the disappointment of that. You know, I don't want to complain too much because, you know, it's not like I was an ER doctor. you know, someone, everyone had their own pandemic experience. So I felt lucky to be healthy and have a house to live in. You know, I'm going to play Los Angeles tonight in front of about, I invited so many of my friends to be in the audience, and I can't tell you how excited I am for it. It's like that the world is starting to open up again, and I'm going to travel. I mean, so I decided, weirdly enough, my friends think I'm crazy, but I sold my house this week in LA. I put all my stuff in storage. Yeah, all my things are in storage. And I'm just going to tour and tour and tour and travel and travel. And I'm just going to live out of a suitcase with a guitar. And that's all I want to do for the foreseeable future.
That makes a lot of sense. I think all of us during this time, even though we all went through it differently, we all had to confront uncomfortable pieces of ourselves, you know, because we didn't have the normal support or even arguably the normal crutches that we had to maybe avoid those vulnerabilities. What did you learn about yourself during this time?
So much. This record, The Ghost in the Wall, every time I write an album, it's usually all my songs are like journal entries. They're all honest accounts of what's going on in my life. And that's how I exercise my demons, or that's how I figure things out about myself, or that's how I talk to people that I don't feel like I can talk to in person. I get it through a song. You know, I get that out through a song. A lot of my songs are love letters to like an ex-girlfriend, or that I didn't know how to express myself honestly, like in person. So I'll write a song to them. So like my last album was called Here Right Now. That was an album I wrote to try to figure out how to be more present in my life, to be in the moment, because I had so much anxiety about the future, always what comes next and worrying about it. And writing an album about it really helped be in the moment, be present, as cliche as that sounds. So this album, The Ghost in the Wall, I got locked in my house and I was like, all right, I'm going to take the time to go inward and figure out this one question, which was, I've always been someone who has had a fear of intimacy in my life. Ever since I was a kid, I have these walls up around myself, and letting people in truly, deeply has always been a real problem for me. So I wanted to figure out why. Or I also wanted to figure out which came first. Like, it was like a chicken or the egg kind of question for me. Like, was I born with these walls up around myself, and that's why the people in my life became ghosts? Or did people in my life early on start becoming ghosts and I fortified and built up these walls? So that's what I set about to understand about myself when writing this album.
That's powerful. Well, let's get to one of the songs. I think one of them that really best captures this internal struggle is Goodbye. So let's listen to a little bit of it.
Should I go? Should I walk away? So many things I wish I could say. Catch my reflection, I try to look brave. Then I close my eyes. There's this thing I can't explain. You are the only thing that's keeping me sane. I built a shelter cause it's calling for rain. I should let you inside. But goodbye, I'll be gone by the sunrise. Cause I'm in love with the next time. Yep.
Joshua, you know, what's going through my mind while I'm listening to this is that you were creating this album remotely with someone you've never met in person. How did you overcome all of that?
Well, at first, my record label said, during the pandemic, they said, well, we'd like you to release a new album. And I said, well, I've been writing all these songs in lockdown, but I'm not really a producer. I mean, I play guitar and I sing and I write these songs, but I can't play drums and I can't play bass and I can't, you know, there's certain things that I just can't play in my house. And I've never made an album remotely. How do we do this? At first I was cynical and I thought, let's just wait till the world opens up and I can go into a studio with a producer and bring a band in and do it how I normally do it. And then they said, well, we don't know. Some scientists are saying this could last years. And I was like, well, let's give it a shot. Let's find a producer. Let's find a producer that plays everything from his studio. And we'll see. We'll just send each other files via email and see what happens. We'll do one song. And if it works out, we'll keep going. So we did one song. And Jonathan Wilson is the guy that I hired to produce this song. And he's incredible. It just a multi-instrumentalist and so talented when it comes to all of them. And so I thought he'd be the perfect fit. And we'd never met before. I just heard of him. And we share a piano player. When he tours his own music and I tour my music, we have the same piano player. So we tour at different times. So I know Jonathan's music and I've heard lots of stories about him and how great he is and how kind he is. But yeah, I'd never met him in person. Just I'd been a fan. So we did this one song and I thought it sounded great. And I was like, wow, this was actually a really interesting way to go about making music that I never thought I'd be able to do. Just giving each other notes back and forth. And technology has become such that that we could, like we're doing like this. We're doing this interview on Zoom right on my iPad in a hotel room outside the venue that I'm about to play tonight in LA. And, you know, it's like we acclimate, you know, journalists, artists, musicians, producers, you know, we acclimate. And that's what human beings do. And that's one of the things I've learned about myself during this pandemic is that I shouldn't be so cynical when someone says, well, just because we've never done it this way, let's try a new way.
Right.
And so one of the things that's, I guess, just one of the many things that one of the positives that came out of the pandemic, you know, even though there were so many negatives.
Joshua, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited that you're going to be playing in front of your friends tonight and that you're going to be joining us in Sacramento at the Sophia on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm so excited to get up there. I love that little town. I love walking around Sacramento. So cool. I love that old part with the old trains and
the waterfront, old Sacramento. Yep.
I love old Sacramento. I always, if anyone wants to see me, I'll be on the day of the show. I'll be walking around there and stopping in every place I find to eat.
Oh, there's a lot of good food up here. Thank you so much, Joshua.
Thank you.
Joshua Radin is a singer and songwriter sharing with us his latest album, The Ghost and the Wall, which he'll be performing at the Sophia in Sacramento this Saturday evening. We're going to close out with more of his song, the song You're My Home. In the meantime, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Quick reminder about Cap Radio special coverage today at 3 p.m. on Governor Gavin Newsom's endemic plan announcement. Our coverage will be anchored by Cap Radio's Randall White, and you can listen here or stream it live on capradio.org. And a final programming note as we head towards a holiday weekend, Insight is off Monday for President's Day in its place. Join us for a BBC World Service special edition of Witness History for Black History Month. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Tuesday. Have a great weekend.